It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk to a guest who says despite a lot of criticism, a liberal education is still essential to the country's success.
First, we're talking to a political science and courts expert about the potential future of the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin. Some pundits say the federal court decision halting the investigation could make its way to the United States Supreme Court.
Last week, U.S. District Judge Rudolph Ronda ruled that the type of advocacy done by conservative groups like the Wisconsin Club for Growth is not subject to government control, even if it's done in coordination with an active campaign. Legal experts say the ruling conflicts with some recent Supreme Court decisions.
Jolly Emery is with us. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Jolly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with a brief recap. Last week was a busy one when it came to John Doe. What happened last week in the courts?
Well, what happened is that we first got a ruling from Judge Ronda it's an interesting ruling. First, he ruled that there needed to be an injunction. It's a preliminary injunction which halted the John Doe investigation. And then he went further than that, though. He didn't just say that this is going to be a preliminary injunction before I look at all the merits legal questions in this case. He went on to say that he believed that the First Amendment rights of Wisconsin Club for Growth had been violated by the prosecutors and the John Doe investigation, and he went on to even further to say that the First Amendment protected the type of coordination that they had been engaging in because it was issue advocacy and not what's considered to be express advocacy. Now, from there, there was, of course, a quick appeal, and within 24 hours, his injunction was reviewed by the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, and a three-judge panel ruled that he could not issue the injunction as he had, and that part of his injunction had required that the federal part of Ronda's injunction had required that the prosecutors return documents to Wisconsin Club for Growth and other documents they had gathered during their investigation, and that they were to destroy all their copies. And the three-judge panel of the U.S. Courts of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit said that he could not require that the prosecutors destroy their copies and that they were not required to return those documents. They also said that with respect to the injunction that Ronda could only issue that injunction if he had considered the prosecutor's claim that this couldn't be a federal case because it's a state proceeding and that they're immune to lawsuit was frivolous. And Ronda had not said that in his original ruling, but then came out, you know, within a day and said, well, yes, I do consider this frivolous. However, even though the injunction has been reinstated, the lawsuit continues, and the Seventh Circuit will be looking at a variety of issues, including whether or not this is a case that should be dismissed as a prosecutor's working with the John Doe investigation originally argued.
Well, so some legal scholars are saying that the ruling or the issue that's being raised by all of this back and forth, it's pretty provocative, and it gets into sort of a no man's land of campaign coordination law. How do you see it?
Well, I think that that's right. I think that coordination at the federal level, the idea that FEC regulates campaign coordination and basically argues that states that any time that a campaign coordinates with an outside group, that this is something that is to be reported and regulated by the FEC. And obviously the FEC applies to federal campaigning. The state of Wisconsin goes even farther and considers that any type of coordination that goes on between groups must be reported to the Government Accountability Board. So in this instance, what Ronda has done is he's redefined campaign coordination, and he's basically said that as long as it's issue advocacy, it's protected by the First Amendment, which goes against the FEC's rulings on this issue and definition of coordination, and also flies in the face of the most recent ruling and by the Supreme Court in McCutcheon, which still considered to be coordination something that should be regulated or what's considered in-kind contributions, just like individual contributions.
Well, one important piece of this seems to be that the Supreme Court has thus far viewed this kind of coordination as being similar or analogous to campaign contributions, to money. How does that shake down when you look at this ruling?
Well, I think that there is, with respect to what has transpired here in Wisconsin and the relationship between the Walker campaign and Wisconsin Club for Growth and other groups, yeah, there was coordination going on. And Rhonda doesn't disagree with that. He says that there's coordination, but this was actually what he considers to be legal coordination coordination protected by the First Amendment, because the outside groups, which would include Wisconsin Club for Growth, are aligned ideologically or politically with Governor Walker's campaign. And there's no corruption taking place, he said, because they're not trying to, these groups aren't trying to influence Walker in any way, that they are on the same page. There's no corrupt influencing that could take place. And that basically it's just about educating and informing voters as you would with any other kind of issue advocacy ad. And issue advocacy ads are protected by the First Amendment, and the Citizens United decision did give a lot more First Amendment protection to issue advocacy than they had ever had in the past.
So there is speculation that this could be an area, again, it's sort of uncharted territory, that the Supreme Court could be interested in taking up. We've seen them venturing into this territory, obviously, in recent weeks with the aggregate campaign donations. What do you think about the prospects of it going to the Supreme Court and having this being a new sort of battleground?
You know, anything's possible. And I think that it does seem to fall within an issue area that the court has been very interested in lately. So the court might be, when I say the court, I'm talking about the United States Supreme Court. They might be willing to what's called grant cert or agree to take this case because they want to expand or allow for coordination under certain instances, which would be for issue advocacy as opposed to express advocacy. And express advocacy is where you basically tell people not to vote for a specific candidate, or you say you identify candidates clearly in an ad.
And if this would go to the Supreme Court, say, and the Supreme Court should decide that Judge Rhonda decided correctly in their view that this is relating to the First Amendment and should be protected, how would that change current campaign finance rules?
Well, it would change rules with respect to the definition of coordination. So coordination, if it's issue advocacy, would then be permissible and would not require reporting as it now stands. It requires that it be reporting like any other in-kind contribution. It would probably ratchet up the spending. Some analysis of the recent McCutcheon ruling said that because the Supreme Court had not touched coordination or kept rules regarding coordination in place, that there is sort of this leveling effect, even though donors can, you know, basically give lots more money than they could before. Under coordination, they still cannot coordinate directly with agents of a political campaign. But, you know, this would allow for even more money to come in, or maybe not even more money, but relax the rules and less reporting. So we don't know who is giving the money, who has the influence.
How is the Supreme Court trending over the last couple of years when it comes to laws affecting campaign finance and coordination?
They're trending, well, some might say they're trending in the direction of greater or broader free speech rights, and others would say they're trending in the direction of more money and maybe affecting democracy.
And so as far as the appeals process goes, so what do we expect to see there?
Well, the first thing that the appeals court is going to have to consider is whether or not this case should be dismissed. The prosecutors, as I said before, had argued that Wisconsin Club for Growth did not have a case, that this is basically a state issue. It doesn't belong in federal courts, that the federal district court judge, Rhonda in this instance, should not have heard the case, and that the prosecutors themselves were supposed to be immune from any sort of liability or prosecution. And so we'll have to see how the court rules on that. If they rule on that way, then you can still obviously have an appeal on the part of Wisconsin Club for Growth. But we also have other cases that are along these same lines involving the same issues percolating up through the state courts right now.
All right. So this one is with the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. Is there a timeline that you're expecting here?
I'm not exactly sure. They have the Circuit Court of Appeals has given the parties, I think, until July to file their briefs. So we won't really see any action until after July, after the briefs have been submitted and they have the opportunity to go over those arguments, but these things have been moving so quickly. I mean, the speed with which this has been, as far as the legal side, not necessarily the John Doe investigation, but as far as the court side is concerned, has been moving at such a quick pace that I would expect that a ruling would come out fairly quickly, maybe August.
All right. Well, we'll be watching it, and I'm sure you will too. Jolly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Jolly Emery, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater.
There's been a lot of criticism aimed at liberal arts college education these days. It's too expensive, fails to prepare students for real jobs. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
But our next guest says that this criticism of liberal education is nothing new. And despite centuries of naysaying, a liberal education has long been essential to America's flourishing democracy and will remain essential for a long time to come.
Joining us now is Michael Roth. He's president of Wesleyan University. He's author of the new book, Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I mentioned a couple of the common catchphrases there. Too expensive, not leading kids to a real job in their careers. We hear a lot of that. What's your reaction when you hear those?
Well, I think there's grains of truth in those complaints. The costs of higher education and for many people have gotten out of control, and there is for many schools an arms race in providing amenities for students in order to attract those who've acquired a taste for luxury. And then in the large public universities, there's just been a tremendous decline in support for education. And one of the things that struck me as I began to do the research on this book was that these issues, whether you're just giving students too much luxury when they come to college, or whether the state should support higher education with higher taxes, these are issues that Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin were talking about a long time ago. And so I think that in America, there's been a healthy tension between having a broad contextual education, the usefulness of which isn't immediately obvious, and the demand for being practical and pragmatic, which is also a deep American cultural attribute. And so I think that that tension keeps our colleges and universities producing students and producing research that is really useful, that students who do have practical skills. At the same time, it doesn't try to simply serve the immediate interests of employers, which I think would be a great mistake. So that tension between the broad contextual education and the practical education is a healthy one. Contemporary pundits who say we should just, you know, get rid of the broad contextual education in favor of some narrow utilitarian instruction, I think they're really just trying to make sure that the status quo doesn't change, that those people who have great jobs and do have access to power and money will retain that, and the people who they don't think deserve that will be, they'll be instructed for very narrow technical tasks.
Liberal education, the phrase, might mean different things to different people. What does it look like? What should it be?
It's a broad contextual education. That means it looks at whatever subject is at hand, not just in terms of its immediate meaning in the world or its immediate value in the world, but tries to understand it conceptually and historically. And so what that means is you approach a subject, and it could be engineering, or it could be history, it could be physics or religion. You approach that subject with the idea that through the study of that subject, what you learn is how to learn, how to continue your inquiry, how you can continue to your quest for understanding. Because what we want from our students when they graduate colleges and universities is not just immediate preparation. We do want them to have certain skills, but we also want them to be adaptable. We want them to be able to translate things. We want them to have learned how to learn and to acquire a taste for inquiry that will serve them for a long time after graduation. I actually think right now this is much more valuable than it ever was, because the pace of change today is so much more rapid than it has been in the past. And if you're prepared for, you know, your first job in college, that's going to be your worst job, the worst job you'll ever have, I hope. But the world is going to change very rapidly. And what you want to be able to do is not just react to change or be a victim of it, but to shape change. And I think a liberal education, whatever the subject is you're studying, a broad contextual education that looks at things from a variety of perspectives, that produces in our students the ability to keep learning and to create change and create innovation.
Probably one of the most dreaded questions for an educator at any level, or dreaded statements, is, I'm never going to use that. Whether it's an engineer, say, talking about a social science class, or somebody who's going to go into writing talking about math, how do you make the case to the student themselves that that well-rounded contextual education is good for them?
Well, I think that it starts earlier than a college education. It starts really in elementary school and high school, where students, if they when they have an education that's not just built about getting being successful on a test, if it's really built on learning how to learn, they acquire the taste for learning. And not everybody has it in the same way, obviously, right? Some people will go to college and they'll take a Shakespeare class and they'll be over the moon. They'll think that's really wonderful. Other people will be bored silly. It's not one size fits all. But I do think that the students who come to colleges and universities should have their curiosity cultivated. They don't know exactly what's going to be useful tomorrow, because nobody knows what's going to be useful in 5 years. What we need for them to do is to understand how they think well, how they can initiate inquiries that are productive, how they can make things that other people find valuable. So in liberal arts colleges and universities today, there are many ways to pursue this. Some people it might be in computer science, and other people it might be in music. And then we have plenty here at Wesleyan who are doing computer science and music. Now, they don't know exactly what's going to be useful, but when they graduate, they have the capacity to put things together in new ways. And the ability today to put things together in new ways and ways that other people find valuable is an enormous resource. That's one of the great things that, you know, that technology gives us, is a facility of recombining things, reconnecting things in ways that other people will find useful and valuable. And students see the joy in that, see the pleasure in it. But again, not everybody is going to find it in the same way. You know, long ago, and in the European tradition, liberal arts meant certain subjects. So you had to learn Greek, or you had to learn certain things about certain historical epochs. That's not what liberal education in America is about. Liberal education in America is about learning the practice of inquiry and creativity. And that can happen in a number of disciplines.
Well, and it sounds like in this case, it's not so important what you teach and learn, but how you teach and learn. Any subject could be taught in a way that goes toward that context and the ability to recombine what's out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just that you're not trying to learn just so you become a specialist. You don't want to learn just so you become pedantic. You want to learn in such a way, whatever the subject is, that you can become more creative with what you know. I'll give you the example of a student who graduated from Wesleyan just a couple of years ago, who was doing an art major and combined with computer science, and he built these extraordinary sculptures that were based on an algorithm that he created. The size of the sculpture was determined by how much money a friend of his, who was the model, made for Google through their advertising. So he had their all fully to scale, but some of them were enormous because the people did a lot of searches and used a lot of clicked on the ads, and others were very small scale because they didn't earn as much for Google. Well, he didn't know if that was going to be useful. He had this idea of a cool art project, which actually was really cool, and it was displayed in his gallery. But when the folks from Google heard about it, they offered him a job. Now, that's a great success story, but it's a success story not because he knew that that's what he wanted to do, but because he let his imagination take wing and develop the skill to turn what he was imagining into something somebody else would find valuable. And I think at our great liberal arts colleges and universities that focus on undergraduate learning, we give students both that giving your imagination freedom, but also insisting that you learn how to build something. In other words, you needed the algorithm had to work, otherwise the whole thing falls apart. You do need to learn certain concrete skills, but to learn them in such a way that you can produce things that other people didn't expect. And that's where value comes from, right? When you do something that's surprising with skills that somebody thought they already understood.
We're talking to Wesleyan University President Michael Roth, author of Beyond the University. We're talking about the value of a liberal education. We want to know what you think. In today's digital age, our competitive economy, does a liberal arts education still matter? If you graduated with a liberal arts degree, how did it help you or hurt you in the working world? Or if you had something that was more career-focused, a technical degree, do you regret that? Do you wish you'd had more of a liberal arts degree, or you're glad you went the way you did? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're talking with Wesleyan University President Michael Roth. In his new book, Beyond the University, he makes the case that in today's increasingly competitive economy, a liberal education still matters and remains important for many years to come. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you agree with them? Do you think liberal arts education is key to individual success, fulfillment, key to our thriving democracy? Or do you think we should focus more on job preparation in higher education? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll go straight to a caller. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a liberal arts education, and I recognize its value. But I also would say that I think in today's situation, the students should know the cost of that education, how they're going to finance it, and then once they're done, the economic outlook for the specialty that they choose, whether it's anthropology or economics. I guess my real thing is that if we are training these people to be thinkers, they should have all the facts so that they know the situation that they are putting themselves in as they pursue this liberal arts education without the bankable skills that other educations provide. Thank you.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Michael, some contextual information about what you're getting into in the liberal arts.
Yeah, Charlie makes a good point. I think that that kind of information can be very helpful, but you have to make sure it's accurate. And you know, many graduates from liberal arts colleges and universities actually wind up with higher earnings than people who say, I'm choosing a business degree or business major because I think it's going to be intensely practical. But they find themselves with their business or communications major in a worse position than someone who majored, let's say, in philosophy, but actually has skills that that lots of people find useful. I think it is important for, especially when people are paying a lot of money for these for this education. It's very important for them to understand the value of the degree, but they have to also understand that that value should be revealed over time. It's not just going to be value on day one. It's going to be a value that continues to pay dividends for years after graduation. But, I do think finding ways to control costs of education is such an important thing for those of us in higher ed, whether it's with online courses or whether it's in changing the time to degree. But we have to give our students more vehicles for getting their education in ways that are affordable.
One of the things that struck me on your about your book, and you referenced this earlier, is how non-new these arguments are in some ways. And one that was new to me was going back to Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, figuring out the role of higher education for African Americans in the post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction era. Can you talk us through that debate?
Sure. So one of the things that interested me so much, and I did this research, and I'm not an American historian by my own education. I'm
a French historian, was that the strong current of thinking about education from the Civil War onwards among African-American intellectuals, whether it's David Walker or Frederick Douglass, right in the during the Civil War and then afterwards, or later on with Booker T. Washington, who thought that what was most important is that freed slaves and their immediate descendants should earn it, get a trade and the tools to work it. And Du Bois, who said, you know, a trade is very important, but don't consign people to the job you think, the only job you think they can do. Some people will take a trade and that will be their happiness and their livelihood. But some people will actually, through their education, go take a trade and then do something completely different with it. And what Du Bois was saying to Washington, don't narrow our horizons. He wasn't saying let everybody be a dreamer and think they don't have to make any money. He realized it, just like John Dewey did a generation later, that people are going to have to work. And this is not a liberal education for some elite group of rich guys. But Du Bois said, don't limit our horizons just because we come from an oppressed group of people. Don't just because we were slaves. Don't limit our horizons. Expand our horizons. And education expands your horizons.
Well, and you mentioned, I think your version of the joke is bartenders with chemistry degrees around, yeah, at least in the Madison part of Wisconsin, it's cab drivers with PhDs in philosophy. You seem to make the case, why not?
Well, I think that the rhetoric of certain critics of liberal education today is really rhetoric about people who don't like the idea that citizens are learning enough so that they can actually think through their own political choices and the choices in their own lives. We used to say, you know, those old World War II movies where the guy who knows how to read Shakespeare or something, but he's not actually a professor. He just loves Shakespeare or some other form of literature. There was a sign of the kind of the American democratic ideal that you could be a cab driver and you could have intellectual interests. You could be a mailman and have a PhD. And the critics say, well, why would you want to have a PhD if you're only going to be a cab driver? Well, that's up to the person who has expanded her or his intellectual horizons. Now, I'm not that naive to say that somebody might be in great debt and, you know, and having a job they don't like. That is a problem. And we have to find ways to control the cost of higher education. But the fact that we want our citizens to have a broad contextual education, not necessarily a PhD, of course, but a broad contextual education, that's a great thing about America, not something to be lamented. And, you know, if people want to stay in Madison or Milwaukee because they love the cities, but they have advanced degrees, then they'll find other things to do. But for me, that's not a waste. That's actually they're bringing their education to their lives in ways that perhaps faculty members don't.
Well, turning to the frontiers of modern education, we see the rise of the MOOCs, the massive open online classes, and a lot of attention has gone toward the very practical one. I'm going to get certified in blank by taking this massive class. You say, as a guy who advocates liberal arts education, hey, maybe there's room in here for us too.
Absolutely. I've taught probably 100,000 students online in the last year and a half. And I have spent my life in small colleges, ever since I was a student at Wesleyan in the 70s. And so in the last 2 years, I've taught a great books course on Coursera through our Wesleyan partnership. And I taught a course called How to Change the World, which is about politics and activism and the global challenges they face. And I have found teaching these students from all over the world, I mean, more than 100 countries are represented in our classes online, I have found a vigorous appetite for learning and for debate on the discussion boards and for penetrating inquiry from many of the students. So I know that it's not the same to teach teaching a course, let's say, with Virginia Woolf's our reading for the week. It's not the same to teach that to 50,000 people online as it is to teach it to 15 people in my office.
But there is something extraordinarily powerful about teaching great books or teaching about art or teaching about film online. And what we have discovered is that there is an enormous appetite all over the world for American liberal education. And that for me is very encouraging. And our courses, the ones we mount, they're not very expensive to put together. We don't try to fill it full of bells and whistles. People don't want that. They want authentic intellectual stimulation through video and discussion boards. And I think that the response to it has been extraordinarily encouraging for somebody like me who's been teaching these kinds of courses, you know, for the last 25 years.
You've made the case, as we've been talking, about the personal benefits of the liberal education, a well-rounded liberal arts contextual education, both for personal fulfillment mm-hmm. and for our careers. What's in it for us as a society of making sure that at least a good chunk of people are getting this kind of liberal arts education?
Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson said it long ago that education is our best defense against tyranny. And the ways in which tyrannical governments or rapacious economic elites control other people is by pulling the wool over their eyes, is by convincing them of things that aren't true, is by denying their rights while pretending to do otherwise. And the best defense against that is an education. So you don't have to learn Greek, you don't have to learn a certain historical epoch, or it's not about a particular kind of class, but to learn how to participate in inquiry is what protects our democracy, our fragile democracy, from the oligarchy and from government domination. And I think it's so crucial, and it's been crucial throughout American history. I mean, Ben Franklin said much of the same thing. Du Bois said it. Dewey said it. Martha Nussbaum says it today, that a broad contextual education is what gives us as citizens the capacity to understand how we're being governed and to change how we are being governed. And I do think when people complain about education today, they often want us just to be more conforming to the status quo, and education could give us the tools to be critical of the status quo.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
That's Michael Roth. He's the president of Wesleyan University. His new book is Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. May 12th marks poet Laureen Niedecker's 111th birthday. The critically acclaimed poet spent much of her life in Fort Atkinson. Poet Emily Lindemann tells us about one of her non-poetry works, a personal cookbook.
I first discovered it on the Friends of Laureen Niedecker website, and it caught my attention right away. I think the first quote from Laureen in her handwriting was included. She writes, "The fact that I don't know much about the subject of cooking should entitle me to write a book about it," and then signs her name Laureen. She started creating it in 1963 and then finished it in 1964, so it really takes place her first year of marriage to Al Millen. When you open up the book, it sometimes reads like a little playbook, a little script between her and Al. And I'm thinking this was their first year of marriage, so they were experimenting in the kitchen, trying to figure out what it meant to be living together as husband and wife and trying to cook up these concoctions and share their knowledge with one another. I'm guessing these were tidbits of things they would say to one another. For example, when the book starts out, they're talking about bacon. She says, "First, bacon, at once the cool, crisp core of cooking and the fatty fruit of life. Without it, one does not even get up in the morning," says Al. So I'm sure that's something he actually said. But on the other hand, I believe she's making herself and Al into characters. It's this really interesting mix of sometimes home remedies, sometimes reflections, and there are some recipes. Like, there's a section of the book where Laureen delights in cooking that involves alcohol, like whiskey cake and a cherry dish, and other times it will be some musings on their life together. It's very playful as a whole, very fun and witty. You know, and these aren't distinct recipes. It's not like with a cookbook where we would get directions for the temperature and the cooking time and exact amounts of ingredients. These are just kind of sketches of dishes that seem to work out well together and bits of history. And you know, the food isn't always very practical. It's not like she's trying to share this with other housewives and other families and giving them some quick cooking advice. It's more like a poet looking at the kitchen. Lorraine outright says at the beginning that she doesn't consider herself much of a cook. In fact, she says that before she gets married, she made biscuits with whipping cream, and she kind of laughs at that, and she seems to even emphasize that she seems to be proud that she isn't much of a housewife. I have not, not following the recipes, but I did concoct a whiskey cake. I'm not much of a cook myself, but I guess that's why another reason I identify with Lorraine.
Emily Lindemann is a poet and teaches at Silver Lake College. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Find more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. The TV series airs Monday nights at 8. Now we continue our conversation about Wisconsin poet Lorraine Niedecker with biographer Margot Peters. She's the author of Lorraine Niedecker, A Poet's Life. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob.
So how much of a household name was Lorraine as a poet?
I wouldn't call her a household name at all. She's always been a poet's poet, and yet I would emphasize the ripple effect of her poetry and her influence and her mystique ever going wider and wider and wider circles.
What was her poetry like?
Her poetry was concise, terse, rational, and yet very emotional, full of feeling, too. When she had more time to write, after she married Al Millen, who has been mentioned, her poetry became longer. She wrote several long poems, like North Central. And because she had time. Otherwise, she had to work for a living. She was very, very poor. She's a phenomenon. She grew up in isolation, really, in not Fort Atkinson, but Black Hawk Island, which is near Fort Atkinson. And what I mean about isolation is that she really did not know any really influential or important poet in her lifetime. She had no connection.
Can you read us one of her poems?
Yes. This is a poem, seven lines, typical Lorraine, brief, called Wilderness. You are the man. You are my other country, and I find it hard going. You are the prickly pear. You are the sudden, violent storm, the torrent to raise the river, to float the wounded doe.
I read a lot of the poetry, a lot of short poems by her working up to this. That seems pretty representative, short, a lot of, I don't know, a lot of wit there. Mm-hmm. Was that a good representative one, do you think?
I think it is, yes. Very concrete, but tense, terse, but the feeling underneath, you are the torrent, the sudden violent storm, the torrent to raise the wounded doe, which is herself, of course. And the poem is, it doesn't matter particularly, but the poem is about Al Millen, and she found marriage with him both exhilarating and very, very difficult.
Now, you mentioned her on Black Hawk Island, sense of isolation. I think she was sent to college briefly, but then couldn't afford it and went back to the island for quite a while. Did that isolation shape her writing?
I think it did, although she thought of herself as an objectivist poet. The objectivists were a small group, mainly male, mainly urban, mainly leftist poets. She thought of herself as an objectivist, but she was also very interested in the surreal, and she didn't have too much company in the surreal in America. But it shaped, she notices everything about her. Her poetry is about an ear of corn that she walks through. It's about a heron landing on the water. It's about what she sees around her, much, much less than what she hears from other people or other people, the way other people write. I mean, she's unique. She's a unique poet.
She spent, as we've mentioned, most of her life in Wisconsin, except she suddenly upstakes and went to New York. Why and how did that come to pass?
Yes, very strange for Lorraine, except that she had read Louis Zukoski, who was important to her life. He was a New York poet, and he had edited one issue of Poetry magazine, and she read his treatise on objectivism and wrote him, and he answered back, and then she answered, and he answered, and they struck up a correspondence, and finally it was so intense and so mutually sympathetic that she decided to go to New York. And of course, she had to take the bus all the way out there, and ended up meeting Zukofsky at the bus station in Manhattan.
And how long was she there?
Oh, this must have lasted perhaps 4 months, 3 months. She found New York terrifying. She said the thought of getting a job there just was over her head. However, she and Zukofsky became lovers, and he did introduce her to William Carlos Williams, who is a very, very famous poet, but ironically, only to get her birth control so she wouldn't get pregnant.
And so that ended, and she ended up back in Wisconsin, ended up spending the rest of her life here, is that right?
I think, yes, she did, absolutely. She after she married Al Millen, he was still working in Milwaukee, so she had to move to Milwaukee and spent several years there, always with trips to the island on weekends. And then finally, when he retired, she moved back to Black Hawk Island, where she died in 1970, as you said.
And one of her poems was about Black Hawk, ostensibly at least the historical person. I don't know if the island was wrapped up in the imagery there, too.
Well, she had been working on making biographies of important people in Wisconsin. Of course, Black Hawk, not a native Wisconsin, but he certainly influenced Wisconsin. The Black Hawk Wars were fought partly in Wisconsin. So she had learned about him at the Historical Society. And, of course, she was very aware that Black Hawk had hidden his women and children in the mud in the swamps of Mud Lake near the island to protect them from attack. So she knew that. But she's also fascinated by him as an historical figure and a figure of oppression and also bravery, rather like herself.
And what do you see as her legacy? What mark has she left on the literary world?
I think she's left a legacy of courage and giftedness and the a sense of the power that solitude can bring. She was a very lonely person for much of her life, and she used that loneliness. I think she's an inspiration. She is also green in the sense that we are today, but she was long before, you know, deploring wanton killing of wildlife, deploring littering, deploring expanding populations and trailer courts. So she's a very contemporary person, it seems to me.
Margot, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
It was a pleasure.
That was Margot Peters, biographer and author of Laureen Niedecker, A Poet's Life.